Someone once said, at the moment of decision, most of the decisions have already been made. Think about it. At the moment of decision, most of the decisions have already been made. Now, the idea is simply that the decisions we make today are based on and shaped by the decisions we've made in the past. Right? In the framework of faith, how we face the challenges of our faith today or to our faith today has been shaped by how we face the challenges of the past. Yahweh, our Lord, has proven himself to be faithful in the past. So he needs to be trusted in the present. And the strength that he provided in the past should help sustain us in the present. It's the very same strength that's going to continue to strengthen us with our current challenges. You know, this is important for us to understand. You know, we must trust in the God who is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Life isn't just one decision. Our characters are not formed by just one decision. And our faith is not based on just one decision. It starts with one, but it's not based on that. And that's why Paul calls the Christian faith a walk. It's one decision, one footstep, one foot forward after another as we walk with Jesus. The collection of those steps dictate the direction of our steps and the direction of our next step and the step after that. At the moment of the decision, most of the decisions have already been made. All our lives have weight. They have momentum based on the collective influence of those prior decisions. Now, depending on the collective framework of all of our decisions, this thought can either be comforting or terrifying. Right? At the same time, any journey of faith begins with one decision. And the Lord can step in and swoop in and change an entire direction of our walk. Like he did with when Jesus met Paul on the road to Damascus. One meeting, and the direction was changed, the path was changed, the walk was changed. You know, we often look at people who exhibit great faith. You know, those who deal with impossible opposition with joy and faith. And we marvel at how easy their decision is to represent Christ in that moment. What we don't understand is that a million tiny trusting decisions have already been made. And when faced with overwhelming odds, at the moment of decision, most of the decisions have already been made. Jesus talks about this principle when he taught in the parable of the talents. He says, his master replied, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness." Jesus is saying that the cumulative effect of step-by-step small decisions of faith end up being a greater capacity to be faithful when the stakes are much higher and the call to being faithful seems so much more critical. And as far as Jesus is concerned, the key to being faithful is the small things. It's being prepared by the small steps in life to have victory when the big challenges come. Do you ever think of your life as a life of preparation? If we did, how would it shape us? What decisions would we make? Your life is a life of preparation. Preparation for what is to come, not just at the end of time or the end of your life, but what's to come tomorrow and the day after that. Today we're looking at Daniel 8. You'll find this on pages 755 and 756 of the Bibles underneath the chair in front of you, the blue book somewhere around you. Page 755, 756. As you turn there, let me just say that many preachers skip Daniel 8. They may preach chapter 7 and then jump to chapter 9. Or they may even just go from 7 to 12. Or they may just end their series with Daniel 6. We're not going to do that, although I understand the urge. You know, for the past few weeks, I've underlined the importance of Daniel 7. Not only to the book of Daniel, but to the entire Bible, and certainly to Jesus himself, as he saw his identity and his purpose as the Son of Man in Daniel 7. And we looked at how all of that shaped his understanding of who he was, and how he proclaimed it boldly. But Daniel 8 seems to be a little bit of a letdown. There's no lions. There's no fiery furnaces. No enticing details about the end of the world. There's no mutated, terrifying hybrid beasts. No swirling, chaotic seas. We just have a sheep and a goat. It's like we're starting a zoo or something. And while the vision Daniel has may be in his future, it's in our past. It's already happened. It's old news. So Daniel 8 doesn't get a whole bunch of love. In Daniel 8, we have a return to Hebrew. The Aramaic that started in chapter 2, verse 4, is over, and the rest of the book is in Hebrew. Why? I think it's simply because that the rest of Daniel is a message for God's people. All of it is a message to God's people, but it's a message for their future. Even though they're still in Babylon, the focus is going to be on their relationship with Yahweh. And this is a way of making that more intimate and more focused. It'll be a timeless message that will keep them and comfort them well into their future, well beyond their context of Babylon. Beginning with verse 1, we read, "In the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, I, Daniel, had a vision after the one that I'd already, the one that had already appeared to me. In my vision, I saw myself in the citadel of Susa, in the province of Elam. In the vision, I was beside the Ulai Canal. I looked up, and there before me was a ram with two horns standing beside the canal, and the horns were long. One of the horns was longer than the other, but grew up later." Okay, let's stop there. Now, Daniel tells us of this vision that took place 2 years after the vision that he, or the dream that he recounts in chapter 7. So the time frame continues to be the Babylonian period, prior to the events of Daniel 5. In the vision, Daniel is located near the city of Susa in the province of Elam on the Ulai Canal. Now that's 320 kilometers east of Babylon. During his day, it's an ancient city, and it was the leading city of Elam, but it's really not happening at this point in time so much. Later, however, it becomes the winter residence of the Persian kings. So the significance of the location is probably that it points to the center of future power. You know, after Babylon's time has come and gone, it points to a time of change coming. Now, we don't have to spend a bunch of time discussing the ram with the two long horns, because it, we're told later on by Gabriel, who I think we can trust, he's good with messages, that this is the Medo-Persian Empire. So just as the bear in Daniel 7 represents the same empire, we're told that this ram has one horn that grows longer than the other after a while. And this points to Cyrus' transition from being a Midian vessel, so to speak, to being the ruler of the Medo-Persian Empire. As we go through this, you're going to see all these little intricate details that when it's fleshed out in the history that happens 300 years after this, it's so astounding in its accuracy. So much so that some people simply just claim it couldn't have been written before the events happened. It must have been written after. That's how accurate in telling it is. Of course, that's not true. Daniel sees the ram charging westward and northward and southward. It's quickly expanding its empire, and all other beasts were powerless against it. So this is an image of expansion and growth and power. It seems invincible. It seems indestructible. It seems undefeatable until the male goat appears from the west and moves so swiftly that it appears not even to be touching the ground. Such a great image. It moves across the face of the whole earth, and the male goat sees the ram with the two horns, and it charges with great rage. And it attacks the ram, we're told, furiously, and it tramples it. The ram becomes an ex-ram. If it had learned to become a Dodge ram, it might have survived. Sorry. Interestingly, one moment we're told that the ram was invincible, and then now it's trampled upon, and it's defeated in record time. In short order. That's the way it is. Living through it, sometimes we wonder if the empire will go on forever. And sometimes that gives us a sense of security, and sometimes that gives us a sense of insecurity, depending on the empire. But it should be neither. Because any empire standing in opposition to God's kingdom will fall. Rome fell. Nazi Germany fell. The Soviet Union fell. Nothing permanent remains except Christ's rule. We're told that this goat is Greece. Again, this is from Gabriel. It's described with these words: the goat became very great, but at the heights of its power, the large horn was broken off, and in its place, four prominent horns grew up toward the four winds of heaven. Expansion again. Once again, we're told about this powerful, this great goat, this prominent horn, and then the heights of its power. At the heights of its power, its horn is broken off. This refers to Alexander the Great. In less than 10 years, he carved out an empire that surpassed the Persians. He was first to unite Europe with the Near East and with northern India. Think about that. But at the peak of his power, he falls ill and he dies, and his empire falls apart, or is at least split apart. The prominent horns replaced by four horns. His kingdom is divided between four of his generals. And we are now talking about the third beast from Daniel's vision in chapter 7, which was depicted with the leopard that had the four wings. These are the only two empires we're dealing with in chapter 8. Now again, we have this great power of unprecedented in its achievements suddenly suffer a tremendous blow. But what's interesting about this vision is that it quickly deals with both the Medes and the Persians and the empire of Alexander the Great. But then it slows down, and it gives us the most details about this small horn, which is one of the four. And what it says about this small horn is quite astonishing. Starting in verse 9, we read, out of one of them came another horn, which started small but grew in power to the south and to the east and towards the beautiful land. You can probably guess what that is. It grew until it reached the host of heavens. It threw some of the starry host down to the earth and trampled them. It set itself up to be as great as the prince of the host. It took away the daily sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was brought low. Wow. You don't have to be up on your apocalyptic prose to know something serious is going on here. Pretty much everyone agrees the horn is Antiochus IV, a Seleucid ruler from the 2nd century BC. He came to call himself Antiochus IV Epiphanes. That was the title he gave himself. The title means manifest one, or God manifest. So this vision skips over about two centuries of history to focus on this one particular horn, Antiochus IV. He grows in power towards the beautiful land and towards Israel. And Titus IV seeks to become true to his title. He wants his kingdom to grow to heaven. Once again, echoes of Genesis 11, the Tower of Babel. We're told that he wants to reach the host of heaven, and that he throws some of the starry host down to earth and tramples on them. These are phrases used to describe heavenly beings and cosmic battle. What's going on here is more than just political or military conquest. He sets himself up to be as great as the prince of the host. This refers to Yahweh. And he attacks the worship of Yahweh by disrupting the temple sacrifices and the temple itself. Here we have a connection back to Belshazzar in Daniel 5 and his arrogance, his blasphemous use of the temple utensils. These are two people cut from the same cloth. This whole section reminds us of the language of Revelation 12, where John records, "A great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his head. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth." See the connection there. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. You remember in our time in Revelation, probably won't remember, but I'll pretend that you do, that the woman is Israel. Not Mary, it's Israel. She's described with cosmic language. And then you have Satan, the dragon with 7 heads, 10 horns. We know what that means already. We've been talking about this for a while. Lots of power. Lots of rulers. He swept a third of the stars out of the sky. And it's very much like the image in Daniel 8. The dragon means to devour the woman's child at the moment it was born. We know who the child is. This is talking about the cosmic battle being waged behind the scenes in heaven when Jesus was born on earth. Those are the two things going on at the very same time. Not only going on at the same time, interacting with one another, playing against one another. The same event from two flips of the coin, so to speak. So this description of the cosmic battle being waged at the time of Jesus' birth gives us kind of an understanding of what's going on. There's a cosmic battle going on, but it's being played out on earth, particularly through Herod, who tries to devour Jesus after he hears about his birth in Bethlehem. So we can get the same insight here. What's going on with Antiochus isn't just political power giving some grief to a few Jews. There's a spiritual dimension to it. This is an out-and-out attack on Yahweh taking place in the heavenly realms while it's also being played out in Palestine. This becomes clear in the angel Gabriel's explanation of the vision. Jump down to verse 23. "In the latter part of their reign, when rebels have become completely wicked, a stern-faced king..." Remember these descriptions of Antiochus. "A stern-faced king, a master of intrigue, will arise." This is the little horn here. "He will become very strong, but not by his own power." Notice the "not by his own power" part. In other words, there's another power behind him. There's another agenda going on. He's a willing puppet, so to speak, of the cosmic battle. And his victory is being fueled and influenced from the heavenly realm. The enemy is playing God once again. And then we come to verse 12. Verse 12 gave me fits, okay? I'm just letting you know that. It's given everyone fits. It's a notoriously hard verse to translate. It's part of the problem. Now, what does it say? According to the NIV, "Because of rebellion, the host of the saints and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. You'll notice the NIV has brackets around the phrase "of the saints." This is the NIV's way of saying that those words were inserted by them and they aren't in the original text. They've placed them in there for what they see as clarification. Now, by doing this, they're suggesting something in their translation. They're saying that we're talking about the Jews who are resisting the small horn and are attacked as a result. But again, that's supplied. That's an interpretation. So verse 12 could be talking about the heavenly host or the heavenly army, which is in the text, and the small horn assault on God in the cosmic battle, which has evil consequences for God's people. It's probably both. Just like we have in Revelation 12. There's a cosmic battle that rages, and the cosmic battle is at the same time being played out on the murder of the babies in Jerusalem, in Bethlehem, as Herod becomes a tool of the dragon. How does this all play out in this, though? Look at verse 24. He will become very strong, but not by his own power. He will cause astounding devastation and will succeed in whatever he does. He will destroy the mighty man and the holy people. He will cause deceit to prosper. He will consider himself superior. When they feel secure, he will destroy many and take his stand against the Prince of Princes. Yet he will be destroyed, but not by human power. He will cause astounding devastation and take his stand against the Prince of Princes. We know much about the small horn because of the intertestamental writings of the Maccabees. Antiochus starts out small and grows large. He was not actually the first in line to succeed. You know, his older brother, Seleucus the Fourth, was. But through political manipulation, for which he became famous. Remember again verse 23. He's a master of intrigue. He managed to push his nephew out of the way and gain the throne. He grew large through military success, pushing his influence into Egypt as well as east into Persia and Parthia and Armenia, as well as Palestine, of course, which is the focus of what's going on in chapter 8. Antiochus IV established himself as a completely wicked and stern-faced king, verse 23. True to his description, through this incredible intrusion and disruption into Jewish life and faith, it's really quite remarkable. You see, Jewish religion and practice stood in the way of his policy of Hellenization. The Greek way was superior to his mind, and the only good person was a Greek person, and if you weren't a Greek person, you better become one or you're going to die. That was his intention. So, he not only killed any male children who were circumcised, he then hung them around their mother's neck. It's a kind of a forced policy, I would say. He confiscated the Torah. And if anyone was found with the Torah, they were killed. In the words of verse 12, the truth was thrown to the ground. Look at the details here. Then he stopped the temple sacrifice in 167 BC. And he profaned the temple by introducing a holy object sacred to Zeus. So he transformed it into a temple for Zeus. This temple for Yahweh. And then he sacrifices a pig on the altar. We know the significance of that, don't we? You know, this is so much more than just an attack on the religious faith of God's people. It's an attack against heaven itself. This would be a brutal time for God's people. They would experience things unlike anything else they had that had happened to them. Even to a certain extent, what takes place in Babylon during the time of Daniel's writing of this vision. Just imagine what it was like to go through this. How hard would it have been to keep your faith when the dwelling place of your God was allowed to be desecrated in such a way. And the temple could no longer function in the worship of Yahweh. That's a crisis of faith. How could God allow that to happen? You know, some would give in to that. Some would compromise with the culture. Gymnasiums were built in Jerusalem, and some of the Jews had their circumcisions reversed. That's hardcore playing into the culture, I'd say. So they could play sports in the nude, in the Greek style. That's what it was all about. Those zany Greeks. How much pain, how much loss, how much suffering is represented in this passage? We can't even comprehend. And all of it was done to wipe out the Jewish faith and the worship of Yahweh. Then we're told in verse 25, though, yet he will be destroyed by not by human power. Yahweh inspired and empowered the Maccabean freedom fighters. He gave them victory and he allowed them to restore the temple to the worship of Yahweh. This is where the celebration of Hanukkah comes from. But more than that, Antiochus dies of bowel disease so nasty that it drove him to madness. He died, but not by human hands. Once again, the theme is clear. All these seemingly invincible powers, including the powers that are empowered in the ultimate cosmic battle, the spiritual powers, are no match for the power and the sovereign will of our God. But still, this is such a difficult message. Such a strange passage. You have all this detail given about Antiochus and his brutal demonic assault on God through the attack of God's people. And then you have just 10 simple words that point us to God's activity in the whole chapter. Well, there's a few other hints. But it's not a balanced situation here. It's almost like a PS at the end of a violent, bloody nightmare. Yet he will be destroyed, but not by human power. The end. That's all it says. Really? Really? That's all we get? That's all that Daniel's told? He's shaking in his boots, and it's like, don't worry. I guess that pretty much sums things up, I suppose. It gives you all the details you really need to know. But still, the overall feeling of this vision is that God's people are in for a horrendous time. And that's the taste that's left in your mouth as you read it. That's the image that doesn't just go away. It's burned into their minds. The focus is on the pain and the suffering, not the victory. Although the victory is clearly decisively and determined to happen. Why such a brief period of time spent on the Medo-Persian Empire? Why such a small period of time on the initial parts of the Greek Empire? Why only a brief statement about Alexander the Great? Why all this time spent on one small horn that nobody can really remember the name of? I'll let you think about that for a moment or two. Let's deal with a few more things before we wrap up. We need to look at verse 13 and 14. They, along with verse 25, are the key verses of Daniel 8, if you want to understand what's going on. In verse 13, Daniel overhears a heavenly conversation. He's eavesdropping. Then I heard a holy one speaking, an angel. And another holy one said to him, how long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled? The vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that causes desolation, and the surrender of the sanctuary and of the host that will be trampled underfoot. He said to me, it will take 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary will be reconsecrated. Notice the ending is quite different than Daniel 7. Daniel 7 ends with these words, this amazing declaration. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to the holy people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. Daniel 7 ends with the end, with the culmination of all things. But here in chapter 8, the resolution is the reconsecration of the sanctuary after the rebellion that causes desolation. The phrase should ring a bell. Jesus uses it to warn his disciples about the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD. So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Get out of town. It's an interesting passage because Jesus uses Daniel 8, which has already been fulfilled before Jesus' birth, but he uses it to point to a future event that, of the destruction of the temple. Jesus uses Daniel's warning to warn his own disciples. It should give us a bit of a hint into what the whole purpose of chapter 8 is about. But all that aside, the point I'm trying to make is that when Gabriel says, I am going to tell you what will happen later in the time of wrath, because the vision concerns the appointed time of the end, or as the NIV footnote also translates it, because the end will be at the appointed time. That's also a valid translation. The end that he's referring to isn't the final end. It's not the big end. It's not the end to end all ends. It's the end of the time of extreme difficulty as the result of the cosmic battle between Antiochus IV and God's people, as well as the host of heaven and the powers that motivate and use Antiochus for this heavenly realm cosmic battle going on. In the very least, this specific ending ends for sure in 163 BC when Antiochus dies. Which isn't to say it doesn't also reflect into future events. Jesus himself uses it for that purpose. And this Antiochus guy, he's a poster boy for the Antichrist, you know. You can see it there. But that's not who he is. He's just of that type. He's one of those guys. He's part of that club. And speaking of when this will end and how this terrible time of persecution and destruction will last, we have another number. Better than the number in chapter 7, which is time times half a time. But still, no one has an agreement in exactly what we're talking about here. There's three possibilities. The number 2,300, what does it mean? The reference to evening and mornings could be referring to evening and morning sacrifices in the temple. In that case, you divide the number by two, and you end up with 1,150 days in total. Or it could mean simply 2,300 days, although it's a strange kind of, even number there. Or three, it could be taken symbolically. So which is it? Well, it depends on who you talk to. And all of the things, three are possible. You can fit both literal numbers into the middle of the 2nd century BC because it's a matter of where you begin and start your counting. It's like this with most apocalyptic stuff, which should give us pause for being arrogant about these things or thinking we really know. You know, for example, does it start at the stopping of the temple sacrifices in late 167? Or does it start with the removal of Onas III from the high priesthood in 171? And when does it end? With the reconsecration of the high priesthood in 164? Or with Antiochus dying in 163? There's lots of variables here. You can kind of cram either one of those numbers in there somehow and, you know, make it work. Or is it simply that this is a symbolic number given the apocalyptic nature of the text? Well, I personally favor the last few on the principle that apocalyptic literature numbers are generally symbolic by default. Unless you have a really good reason to think otherwise, they should always be taken as symbolic. It's just how that literature works. Still, 2,300, it seems more literal than symbolic, doesn't it? Well, maybe not. If you divide 2,300 by 365, you know, the days in a year, you end up with just over 6 years. Or watch what I do with this. Just less than 7 years. That being the case, the message would be that the time would be cut short. That's all it would mean. To put it another way, the purpose and the result of the persecution would be interrupted and not be allowed to be completed. God would step in before it's finished, and he would end it. Why use days? Well, here's what I think. Again, just, you know, it's what I think. Take it for what you want. The use of days to me suggests the extreme nature of the persecution. You know, when you're enduring something terrible, you don't think in terms of years or months, right? It's days. In every movie about someone in prison, they're always carving a line for each day that they're counting, that they're stuck in prison. You know, when we've been undergoing chemo, you talk about days and you talk about treatments. You don't talk about the whole thing. When you've been separated from someone for a long time, and you know the time of being reunited is coming, you start to count down the days before they return. So the use of days is most likely a symbol of how tough the time will be for God's people. It will be the kind of time where you count days, probably hours, not months, not years. At the same time, what's being communicated is no matter how tough the time will be, God will step in and come to their rescue at his appointed time, when he determines the time is right. And so we really don't have to figure out which of the three it is, because that remains true for all three interpretations. And that's the message we're supposed to get out of this. You know, there's one last verse I want us to look at, verse 27. This is Daniel's statement after the vision, after his talk with Gabriel, who fills him in on the details. I, Daniel, was worn out. I laid exhausted for several days. Then I got up and went about the king's business. I was appalled by the vision. It went beyond understanding. This vision has so much evil, so much pain, so much suffering that Daniel can't get out of bed for days. Literally. He was appalled by this vision. He couldn't understand it. I take that to mean that he couldn't understand why God wouldn't stop it sooner. Why he wouldn't end the suffering quicker. Daniel's a mess. Physically, emotionally, and spiritually. This is a crisis that leaves him with a decision to make. Here he's stuck in exile. Powers greater than him control his life. And sometimes the immediate powers, the powers of Babylon, are the only powers that he really sees. And that's why Daniel is reminded through the activity of God in the background that Yahweh is the God of heaven, the one who is in control of the nations. And that's why the message plays and replays in every chapter of Daniel, including chapter 8. This is a truth that Daniel has to be reminded of time and time again. Because each morning when he wakes up, it's a challenge to believe. But then we have Daniel, his statement in the middle of the sentence. Don't miss it. In a way, it's just so mundane and it's so ordinary and it's so seemingly insignificant. But in another way, it's heroic and brave. It's fist-shaking, foot-stomping declaration of faith. I, Daniel, was worn out. I lay exhausted for several days. Then I got up and went about the king's business. I was appalled by the vision. It was beyond understanding. He got up and he went about the king's business. Clearly, there's no resolution. He doesn't get up because he's got it solved. He doesn't get up because he's got the answers. He doesn't get up because he's happy about what's going to happen. He continues to be appalled. He continues to be baffled by the whys and the hows and how can this be. But still he got up and went about the king's business. In other words, Daniel faced this crisis, this challenge, this assault on his faith and on the future of his people by simply doing the only thing he could do. He got up, he got dressed, and he continued to be a faithful light in a very dark place. He continued to serve Yahweh by being a faithful, godly man of integrity. He kept going. At the moment of decision, most of the decisions have already been made. Life isn't just one decision. Our characters are not formed by just one decision. And our faith is not based on just one decision. The collection of each step dictates the direction of our next step and the step after that. You know, we often look at people who exhibit great faith in the face of impossible opposition, and we marvel at their decision to represent Christ. What we don't understand, again, is that a million tiny trusting decisions have already been made. And when faced by overwhelming odds, at the moment of decision, most of the decisions are already made. Daniel has made a million tiny trusting decisions. He trusted God to work out the issues of diet. He, when he's faced with a decision to only pray to Darius, he just continues to pray the same way that he prayed all the time. Not in protest, not in public, not a display of rebellion, just tiny intimate steps of faithful, intimate fellowship with the God he was trusting. Just his routine. Just his tiny steps. Why do we have Daniel 8? What's the point? Most people don't see a point. That's why they skip it. That's why they don't preach it. The point was to give Daniel a message so that the people would be prepared. Let's say I'm walking down a dark hallway. I'm not giving anyone any ideas here. And unbeknownst to me, someone has snuck into the building. Say I'm downstairs. And I got all the lights turned off usually when I'm not here, when I'm here just by myself, except for my office. I'm walking down a dark hallway. Someone's hiding in a doorway, waiting for me, waiting to scare me to death so they can laugh. There's a very good chance they're going to get their wish if I don't anticipate that someone was there. But if I saw them just before they hit, if I knew something scary was about to happen, I would be prepared. And I would surprise them rather than them surprising me. And the lack of surprise loses the power in the scariness, right? Yahweh's preparing his people so that the scary stuff, when it starts to happen, won't take them by surprise. They'd be able to keep their faith and resist the evil. They would be able to do battle with the enemy and trust that Yahweh at the time appointed by him would bring the terror to an end. Jesus uses this chapter for the very same reason. You know, he wants his disciples, he warns his disciples about the fall of Jerusalem. But notice something about the use of this passage by Jesus. He uses it not just to point to the destruction of the temple or the fall of Jerusalem. He uses it to teach about life in general, life in battle. He uses it to prepare us for life in the in-between time before his first and second coming. He uses it to prepare us for any nasty surprises that might come our way, whenever they may come. Beginning with verse 4, I'll just read it quickly. Matthew 24. Jesus answered, "Watch out that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, claiming I'm the Messiah, and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you're not alarmed. Such things must happen, But the end is still to come. It's not a sign of the end. Nations will rise against nations, kingdoms against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these things are the beginning of birth pains. They're not pointing to the end. Then you'll be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all the nations because of me. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate one another. Many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But the one who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Nothing that Jesus says in this passage is any indicator of his return, other than the last phrase, and the gospel of his kingdom will be preached in the whole world. That gives us some kind of indication. The rest can be summed up with one word: life. It's life. As a believer, Jesus warns us all of the nasty stuff that can and often will be part of our lives because of our faith. He warns us of struggle and pain, of the struggle and pain that will happen specifically because we're living for him in the in-between time. We too, you know, it will be too much for some, he says. Some will give up. Their love will grow cold. But he's saying expect struggle, expect persecution. Expect people walking away from the faith and being given in and deceived and hated. None of these things are signs of the end, and neither are they a sign that Jesus has broken his promise to us to be with us forever to the end of the age. They're just a season of greater struggle for God's people. It's just business. Babylon seems to be flexing its muscle more and more today. But what is the message? The message is simply this: get up and be about the king's business. Get up and be about the king's business. Get out of bed. Show up. Love, give, serve, care. Knowing that God has placed you in this place and in this time. And it will be the day in, the day to day, the consistent, tiny decisions that you make to keep the faith and to trust in the Lord and not throw the truth on the ground that is the Word of God. It's those decisions that we make each day that will prepare us for the big decisions. When we're knocked on the floor, when we're discouraged, when we're broken, when we don't think we can get out of bed, when we're appalled at the state of things. We may have things transpire that we will never understand in our lives. But as long as we get up and be about the king's business, we'll make it through. We'll take our stand. What will have our place in the heavenly battle being waged on the streets of Babylon? And we may be scarred. We may die. But we'll remain faithful. Not because of the heroic faith that we have, but because of the tiny little steps of faith in which Christ has proven himself to us. Not about us. It's about experiencing the faithfulness of Christ in our lives. Amen. Worship team.